Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you all today on a topic that I am very passionate about, which is the nanobio interface. In fact, my PhD dissertation, that was the title of the dissertation years ago whenever I graduated from Rice University, studying nanomaterials and nano-enabled products and thinking about their biological applications and their potential implications in human health and the environment. So again, thank you for joining us today. I want to go over the goal of this webinar and then the quick outline, which is divided into two parts. First, the goal is for you to gain a deeper understanding, not a comprehensive understanding, but a deeper understanding of the applications, including medicine and engineering, specifically bioengineering and environmental engineering, as well as the implications towards human health and the environment of nanomaterials, nano-enabled products, and, of course, the nano-bio interface, the surface of the nanoparticle interacting with the surface of a cellular system, for instance. The first part of the talk is an introduction to the field of nanomedicine and nanotoxicology. Because of time today, I won't be able to get into specific research questions that we look at in the lab, as well as what the community looks at as a whole, but hopefully we'll have opportunities in the future to talk about specific case studies going on in the field, the rapid field of nanotoxicology. And the second part is to look at just a couple of examples very briefly on the commercialization of nanomaterials for biological or environmental applications. And again, hopefully there'll be another webinar specifically focusing on different commercialization projects and opportunities that are out there in the field, in the commercialization sector and space. So, first part, introduction to the field of nanomedicine and nanotoxicology. When we think about the field of nanotoxicology, you can think about the type of particles that we're studying as either the engineered nanomaterial, often abbreviated ENM, versus particulate matter that exists in the ambient conditions of our environments, like our air, water, or soil, or incidental particles that exist after some process had happened, for instance, the combustion engine. This talk is primarily focused on the first type of nanoparticle I mentioned, which is the engineered nanoparticle or engineered nanomaterial. And so we think of these engineered particles as intentionally creating, synthesizing, and characterizing nanoparticles that have two properties. One, that they were synthesized to be less than 100 nanometers in diameter. Every single particle in the particle population was synthesized to be less than 100 nanometers. And the other property is that we're looking for a phenomena that nanoparticle has that is different than the bulk counterpart, the larger micrometer-sized particle. So that's the focus of this particular talk, engineered nanomaterials as opposed to incidental particulate matter. The engineered model nanoparticle, as shown in this particular slide here, and forgive me as I find my tool, my laser pointer here, this is the cadmium selenide nanocrystal. It is made of cadmium and selenium ions in this spherical or dot shape. The particles themselves, the particle itself, this is one particle that is composed of many cadmium ions, which are shown here as these red, these white dots are the cadmium ions. The background over here, this quantum dot, is deposited on an amorphous carbon grid, a TEM grid, transmission electron micrograph grid. And we're looking at this one particular particle, looking for its crystallinity. So the three properties that we look for are, that they have huge surface areas, meaning that these particular particles in a given volume or a given mass within a beaker or a sample container, it has a lot more surface area than if you had an equal amount of mass but of a very much larger particle in another beaker or vial. So the fact of the matter is these particles are very small. It may be counterintuitive to you to think that they have huge surface area, an individual particle, and that's true. But when we think about all the particles that make up the entire mass and compare that to a particle that has a larger size and larger mass, then we have nanoparticles have a huge surface area. The second property is that we specifically made all of the quantum dots in this sample to be exactly 6 nanometers in diameter. Therefore, they're called monodisperse. There are a lot of properties, synthetic methods that are out there that produce bimodal or multimodal sizing profiles for nanomaterials. But ideally, what we work to get towards as nanochemists is to create a sample in which every single particle in the sample is exactly the same diameter, in this case, 6 nanometers. The third property is that we look for particles that are highly characterized and highly ordered. In the case of a cadmium selenide nanocrystal, we're looking for crystallinity, that every single one of these cadmium ions, as shown as these white dots in the TEM image, is lined up in a crystalline form. If we compare this to two other types of molecules that exist compared to the lysosome molecule, which is a representative biomolecule, 3 nanometers in diameter, versus the fullerene molecule, the C60 buckyball, which is 1 nanometer in diameter, you can see that we're on the same order of magnitude size-wise between a engineered nanomaterial and other biomolecules and other chemical compounds that exist either in our body or in the environment. So speaking toward this nanomaterial variety, I put up here a slide of more representative transition TEM images of various nanoparticles, and we're looking at differences in size, shape, composition, classes, and of course their order, if they're crystalline versus amorphous. This first image here are colloidal silver nanoparticles. You can see that these particular particles, some are larger, some are smaller, but all of them are in the order of less than 100 nanometers, and they were synthesized for a particular purpose, as colloidal silver particles to be in a suspension. Another type of particle is here. This is SiO2 that was synthesized not necessarily to be a primary particle itself, but the layers that are here, these layers are all less than 100 nanometers thick. In fact, they're less than 10 nanometers thick, and they're deposited on top of each other to form this knife-like structure here on the nano size scale. Another example are carbon nanotubes, which are shown in this image. Carbon nanotubes are often thought about being very long and tubular structures that are very straight. As you can see in this image, some of them curve and bend and form ropes. They take on a lot of different shapes. Especially at places such as the intersection where they start to curve, you may actually find some functionalization at this particular point that caused the tube to turn in or bend in this particular way. A fourth example is a metal oxide, TiO2, as shown here. These particles are made in a very crystalline material, either anatase or rutile. But you can see that they aren't made as dots or as spheres, but they were made as rice particles, as shown here, for a particular application for photochemistry applications. So moving on to the next slide, I just wanted to zoom in and give you a higher resolution image of each one of these images so that you can really see the beautiful morphologies that you can create and the different shapes that you can create by tweaking the experimental conditions in which you synthesize these things, or you change the starting material and the chemical composition when you make these things. So again, these are colloidal silver. This is SiO2 or silica. This is carbon nanotubes, and this is TiO2. So they're very different, but they're all on the nano size scale. So once you made your materials, you really need to characterize and prove to fellow researchers and prove to the community or the peer-reviewed literature or the company that you're working with and collaborating with that you really know exactly what you synthesized. You can imagine with this, when we're talking about a very small size and talking about a very small mass, any impurity that you add greatly is exploited and extrapolated for things that are so small and so such small mass. So the chemical composition and the purity, any purities that exist in the sample become very important whenever you're thinking about characterizing your materials. And of course, chemical composition can be done by a variety of spectroscopies, even microscopy. If you pair up and marry electron microscopy with something like energy dispersive X-ray spectroscopy, or FTIR, or even some kind of ICP, which is inductively coupled plasma mass spec, or AES, atomic emission spectroscopy. We also, as scientists, especially working at the nano-bio interface, are very concerned or put a lot of time into making either soluble materials or insoluble materials in either an organic solvent or an aqueous solvent. That really depends on how, what your intention and application of the materials are. Do you intend the particle to stay in the circulatory system for a longer time period? If that's the case, then you may not want it to be soluble in an aqueous environment. You may want it to be small enough that it stays in suspension, but stable enough that it doesn't dissolve into counterions. We also, every single publication that you would ever mention in the peer-reviewed literature, or if you're talking to clients in this particular field and wondering what their nanoparticles are, the size and the size distribution and the surface area are always the first property that people will ask you. If you did intend to make your quantum dot 6 nanometers, what is the size distribution around the entire population? Is it monodispersed? Or is it bimodal in distribution, meaning you may accidentally made 6 nanometer quantum dots and a larger component as well? Or you also want to look at the full width at half max of your size distribution peak. So how distributed is the size? Is it plus or minus 3 nanometers? You can imagine if you intentionally made 6 nanometers and your distribution was plus or minus 3 nanometers, then you don't really have a very tightly sized population. You have a very broad distribution there. Plus or minus 1 nanometer is, of course, the gold standard that a lot of nanochemists are working towards. Surface charge is a very important property as well, because this one, especially when talking about the biology and the environment, it's really the surface of the particle that interacts with the surrounding matrix and or the test system. Like bacteria cells or a particular organ or cells that line the airway within the lung if you breathed in the particles. Depending on the surface charge, if it's positively charged, negatively charged, or neutral charge, that will greatly affect the uptake of the particles into the cells or the distribution within an in vivo animal system. That's very important. And then to that, speaking to the surface charge is the surface chemistry. If you intended your particles to be positive or negative or neutrally charged, that can really affect and hinder or accelerate the surface chemistry you're trying to decorate your particles with one way or another. Agglomeration and aggregation is something that people are very cognizant of in the field. We wonder if after exposure, are you still exposed to individual nanoparticles, or were you exposed to an aggregate or an agglomerate of many particles stuck together? And how do things like that change? Well, come to the next column over here, pH. If you change the pH of the test system, then you will change properties such as the agglomeration and the surface chemistry and the surface charge. So I'll stop with this particular slide because I believe you guys have heard a webinar on this topic once before, but it's really something to think about when we are talking about where students and the future workforce need to be changed. At the end of the day, we need to start with a material scientist who knows how to characterize various properties of a nanoparticle. And some of those techniques are different than bulk materials, and some are not so different. So I suppose since you're interested in this particular topic, you've probably thought about these things before. And so I wanted to ask this particular question to you as a group, because you may be experts in this yourself. In your reading and in your experience and in your research, what do you think is the single most important property of a nanomaterial? If you can answer A for size, B for shape, C for chemical composition, or D for surface charge, and of course E for all of the above, please let me know. And I'd like to just speak as you guys enter your answers and remember the times that we live in. To be able to characterize and get really good validated information on every single nanomaterial property, it's just not a reality when it comes to the financial obligation and the resources that we have in 2011 to really be able to be able to do every single characterization. It does look like most people are answering all of the above anyway, so that's good to hear that people understand that these properties are playing into each other. It's interesting to me that nobody has picked D. D would be my choice as the single most important property of a nanomaterial, and you'll see that a little bit as the presentation goes on. But it is good to see that a lot of people recognize that all of these properties are important and that they do play into each other. But keep in mind that as we look to fund research like this in the future, it's really going to become increasingly difficult to be able to characterize every single particle that you have. So moving the conversation a little bit past the material properties themselves and really getting into the title of this talk, which is looking at the bio-nano interface and the bio-nano link, let's start out by understanding some of the key challenges that we currently have in medicine and then start thinking about how the nanoparticles themselves could possibly break down some of these barriers. So the first key challenge in current medicine is translating breakthroughs in the understanding of disease and then into the preventative medicine. So can we understand at the microscopic and even the nanoscopic level of how genes and proteins talk to each other and interact with each other on a cellular level? And understand the progression, the onset and the progression of a particular disease, finding from the very, very beginning what causes the disease to trigger in a particular person, individual, and translating that to preventative. Is there something that we can do to intersect and prevent the onset of disease sooner than what we already understand? How can we increase productivity dramatically? This is something that's a huge challenge in medicine, the waiting time, the sending out, the getting the test results, using the test assays themselves. How can we increase productivity dramatically? How can we align care, healthcare, with better outcomes and efficiencies? This is a very important aspect as we not only look at increasing our types of medicines, and arrays of medicines that we can choose from, but also driving down the healthcare costs. How can we design or how to design affordable healthcare for the bottom of the pyramid? Again, this is touching on the socioeconomic climate that we live in these days to be able to have these sophisticated medicines, these nanomedicines that are going to be very expensive to research. Is that going to translate to being very expensive to purchase? And if that's the case, who is going to have these opportunities and how can we make it even? How to reap the benefit of healthcare by reducing the inefficiencies? Can nanomedicine help with this particular challenge? And of course, this is the largest factor of a country's economic growth, not only here in the United States and in other countries as well, but in developing countries too. So this is a slide that we currently put up in the research and in my classes where we think of how nanoparticles can really influence and help some of these challenges in medicine. So just to orient you, along the top here, we have the different themes. First is the nanotechnology, nanotech platform. The platforms themselves can either be the particles, as I mentioned in the first part of this particular talk. It can be an assembly of nanoparticles that incorporate both maybe a microsphere as well as nanoparticles either decorated on the outside or incorporated on the inside, or maybe using a template, a MEMS device with nanoparticles on it as well. And of course, nanotemplates as well, using the nanoparticles to create the new nanomedicine, but not exactly using the nanoparticles in the delivery of that medicine. Do you understand what I mean? Where I'm saying you use nanotechnologies and nanotechniques to create the medicines, but the nanoparticles and the nanomaterials are not actually included at time of delivery. How are we using these particular platforms? Well, we're looking for functionality. The name of the game is always function, structure and function relationship. So how can the structure in these areas over here really affect the function and improve the functionality of our current medicines? Right now, we're using nanoparticles in sensing and imaging. Right here, sensing, biosensors, and environmental systems, and in the body, as well as imaging, for instance, creating contrast agents for MRI testing. What we're looking for right now, and a lot of money is being put into delivery, using these particular, any one of these particular platforms, and finding a way to deliver a medicine to a targeted location. It's just my opinion, just Christy's opinion, that we are not quite there yet. It's a little bit still off in the horizon and a little science fiction to target one particular type of cell over another type of cell, but I truly believe that we are getting there, and with more research and more talented people coming into this field, we will be able to selectively get to and identify and select a cancer cell over a normal cell, leave the normal cell alone, and do something to the cancer cell or the bacteria cell. What are the methods that we use? Well, this is an interesting thing here. There's nothing new about the methods that we're using with these nanoparticles. Of course, the structure of the particle is different, and using them in this way is different, but we're still using the traditional medicinal methods and applying the same particles or different particles to these particular methods. So proteomics is always a very popular thing. Proteomics, genomics, metabolomics, the whole omics field is latching on and collaborating with nanochemists and nanotoxicologists. We're looking for cell tracking, using fluorescently labeled particles or fluorescently labeled drugs, or maybe the fluorescent component is actually the particle itself. We're tethering drugs, our existing drugs, to the surface of nanoparticles, or we're encapsulating existing drugs inside of nanoparticles for different ways of delivering less drug. The concentration of drug is less, but targeting and having a more efficient way of delivering the drug to the target. Using DNA adducts as well, and of course MRI and other imaging imaging technologies, existing technologies, but using nanoparticles as contrast agents and things like that. And lastly, what are the disease that people are considering or hypothesizing that nanoparticles can help out with? By far, cancer is the most highly studied and highly cited disease that nanoparticles are being applied to. But there are a significant amount of research going on around the world for neurodegenerative diseases, infectious diseases such as malaria or tuberculosis, mental diseases, of course, and then this is, to me, makes the most sense, diseases of the blood. If you can have a nano-sized particle, very small, and maintain its circulation in the blood, then you might be able to do something pretty fantastic in the circulatory system. Nanomedicine can also be about early diagnosis, early and regenerative treatment. So we'll go through these particular this particular slide. The first thing is looking at an X and Y axis, where the X axis is over time and the Y axis is the symptom or the severity of the symptom, where lower is less severe and higher appears more severe. And over time, within the progression of disease, you have a screening process, maybe before the onset of disease, or if you might be more genetically susceptible and you're being watched for a particular onset of disease, this is the screening section where we most of us stay, spend the most amount of time. We have early diagnosis, preventative treatment, and of course follow-up after the disease is, therapy is provided for the disease. And so when we think of the symptom, we can think of them as bearable, stuff that we can live with without going under doctor treatment or even worse, hospitalization, versus clinical symptoms themselves that require some type of invasive activity, either hospitalization or in constant care of a physician that may or may not be uncomfortable. Current medicine, we tend to, if you do happen to be a person who is dealing with a disease, you waffle between the bearable symptom and the clinical symptom for a while until you get to the point where it really is the onset of the disease and the progression of the disease. And if left without treatment, then you would stay up here at a very heightened level that would eventually bring you to full-on disease or eventual death. Current medicine aims to bring that down just a bit to be able to prolong life. The hope with nanomedicine is that not only do we not waffle between the clinical and the bearable, but we stay within the bearable to avoid invasive types of procedures. Very often, we stay down here and we do not get to the point where death becomes a reality. This is the hope and the dream of nanomedicine, and again, I firmly believe that we're going to get to this point as we continue to talk about and develop individual medicine. And nanomedicine will be the key to get us there. Moving on to some of the science, what are the most important characteristics of a nanoparticle for medicine? The surface. As I mentioned before, I asked you guys what is the single most important property. A lot of you said all of the properties are important, especially because they play into and feed into each other, and I completely agree. But if we're looking at one particular property, especially for nanomedicine or even nanotoxicology, I would definitely say it's the surface or the surface coating and manipulating the surface coating to allow for particular target specificity. Here, this image down here, we see a larger microcapsule that has inside of it smaller nanoparticles shown in these blue. So nanoparticles themselves probably have a coating on the outside of them, like shown in this red. And then on top of the red, there might be some functionality of a particular drug or an antibody, immunoglobulin, for instance, that may be on the outside of it shown in this green squiggly line. So these can be encapsulated, and the whole thing is called a nano assembly. It's exploited because, of course, of its extremely small size, not just the microcapsule itself, but individual particles inside of the assembly. And a lot of the times they can be encapsulated, as shown in this image. They can carry a highly concentrated amount of drug. But think locally on the macro environment you see, you have a highly concentrated amount of drug in this microcapsule, but relative to the entire volume of the entire in vivo animal system, like a human or a dog or a cat, this highly concentrated drug is very small relative to the entire volume that exists in an animal system. And of course, the tunable surface charge. And be creative here. It's not just the tunable surface charge on the individual particles, but guess what? It's the tunable surface charge of the microcapsule itself that can really help us tune it one way or another. And of course, depending on the outside environment, depending on things like time or pH or salinity, you can have this outside microcapsule dissolve or break open to release the particular drug based off of environmental conditions that trigger the release of the inside of the drug. Yes, I think at this point we can pause for a couple of questions if you guys want to type some questions into the chat box, and then we will monitor them.
Great. Thank you for that information. So we do have one question here. The participant asks, nanomedicine seems complicated. Do you have to be trained in so many different scientific areas before you can be a researcher in this space?
That's an excellent question. And honestly, if I can bring you back to my laboratory at Texas A&M, I hired a variety of different types of graduate students with a variety of different bachelor's degrees. I had one person who was a material scientist, one person who was an environmental engineer, one person who was a chemist, and one person who was a biochemist. No one graduate student knew all of those disciplines. They had their degrees and their specialties in each of their particular disciplines. But by being part of a group, they not only were able to thrive as being an expert in biochemistry, for instance, but they were able to learn from the other students in the group what were the most important things for them to understand for their dissertations and for the success of their projects, but also learn how to delegate so that you don't have to learn all of the techniques, but you learn how to delegate and manage yourself and manage other people to assign different assignments to different types of educated people.
Okay, great. And kind of along the same lines, we have another participant asking, how far are we from targeted drug delivery in terms of time and in terms of research?
It's a very good question, and I think if you asked four different people, you'd get five different responses. There are some, you know, researchers that are thinking for instance, the next generation of pesticides or the next generation of antimicrobial agents. We may be closer than we think to actually be able to target and kill particular types or provide agents that are bacteriostatic or bactericidal, for instance, for antimicrobial agents. We're closer to that particular type of field. And so not only that for disinfectant for surfaces, but also think about the types of bacteria that live on humans as well. The fact of the matter is we have three times as many bacteria cells crawling on us and in us than we do mammalian cells. We are actually more bacteria than we are human. And so the trick is to be able to really find a balance with that particular bacteria to mammalian cell ratio to maintain a healthy microflora that exists in our guts and on our teeth and things like this, but not be toxic to the mammalian cells that exist. And some people say that that's where we're furthest along in the research. As far as targeted drug delivery, we'll get to that in a couple of more slides, but I would say we're further out for being able to target a cancer cell over a normal cell. So let's move on to the governing principles for nanoparticles in medicine. It's a 4 or 5 step process that people are looking for these particular governing principles that really shape the research landscape. The first is that particles must be on the same size scale as other biological entities. And the two examples here are DNA and viruses. Both of these are really depending, the length of DNA and then the diameter of a virus is about 100 nanometers or even less, and most nanoparticles that are engineered are on the same size scale. So we meet that particular principle. The next is that the particles must be robust and they must be stable. a lot of engineered nanomaterials are mostly metallic. Now, there are the carbon-based nanostructures, like the fullerene molecule, or the carbon nanotube, or even amorphous carbon that are engineered to be 25 nanometers in diameter. But for a lot of the properties that we're looking for in medicine, specifically in bioimaging, the particles have some type of metal associated with them, like colloidal gold or silver, or a shell on top of a quantum dot, or the quantum dot itself, as three examples that are particles that are robust and stable in aqueous suspension. They're not readily soluble in water and do not tend to leach individual metal ions into the surrounding matrix, although there are always exceptions to that rule. The third governing principle is that the particles must be bifunctional and have an imaging core and a biological shell. Now, this is not a governing principle that applies to every single application, but it is the most highly cited type of particle that we're looking for. The nanoparticle itself doing one thing, and then the surface functionalization on the surface doing something else. This is that field called theragnostics, where it is both therapy and diagnostics at the exact same time. If you're going to do both of those at the same time, then you need to have a multifunctional particle. The fourth governing principle is that the functional group on the particle surface must target a receptor on a cell. So this over here is a poor drawing of a cell with the nucleus inside. And it has some receptors on its surface. And ideally, you want the functional group of your bifunctional or multifunctional nanoparticle or nanomedicine to be able to interact successfully with the cell in this particular way. And then the fifth governing principle is that it's not enough just for this association to occur, but there must be some energy applied. Energy in. And then, of course, energy out. You can imagine a detector existing outside that would then detect the intensity or the type of energy out that can then feed information to a remote device. You know, people are talking things like applications on your iPod or other smart device or a laptop or even to a server based within the hospital to collect the information if you're monitoring something over a longer time period. So those are the five governing principles. Keep those in mind as we go through the global nanomedicine research agenda, in which we're looking for the combination of nanoparticles and nanotechnology with diagnostics. We're looking for earlier the better. That's the key. Early and accurate diagnostics in the form of biosensors and miniaturized devices that are also connected to some type of external device as well, some type of detector, a receiver to gain the information and interpret the information so the physician can look at it. Or not even the physician. Ideally, you would want you as the user, as the patient, to get that information, to do something with that information. And then targeted imaging agents to highlight the disease. This is also something that we're looking for with nanoparticles. Targeted drug delivery on the spot. It brings the drug to the target site and then monitor its impact. And we'll go through a couple of pictures and slides with this particular concept in mind. And then regenerative medicine, stimulated repair, to help the body rebuild organs or tissue systems that were damaged. And lastly, to meet the ELSI challenges, the ethical, legal, societal aspects of nanomedicine that really affect not only the regulation of using nanomaterials in everyday life, but also getting consumer buy-in and patient buy-in that they would want to use this particular type of medicine. The first is nanodiagnostics. What we're looking for here is screening personal risk factors. This is really the heart of personalized medicine. A lot of the nanobots that people are synthesizing in the laboratory, and by the way, they look nothing like this over here. This is just an artist's rendition of when we talk about a nanobot, but the nanoparticle itself looks like a spherical, mostly metallic-based entity that has functionality on its surface. But for the purposes of this, of nanomedicine with the science fiction, a lot of these particular images are used and contribute to the nano hype. But they really, in my opinion, even though there is a lot of hype associated with it, it really does give you a graphical representation of what we're talking about by having a nanoparticle itself and delivering a particular type of drug specifically to one cell over another cell. With nanoparticles and the idea of personalized medicine, we're looking to identify populations at risk. We're looking for prediction of risk factors, and again, earlier is the key, earlier, more sensitive and faster diagnostics. And then not only looking at individuals like in asymptomatic patients, but also populations as a whole. We need higher sensitivity in the detection of early biomarkers. And the concept here is that because nanoparticles are on the same size scale as a lot of the biomarkers we look at in blood or in urine or in other physiological fluid, then we might be able to detect smaller concentrations and quantities of that biomarker using the nanoparticle itself. We're also looking for non-invasive and painless diagnostic techniques. And, of course, including the omics into this as well, genes and proteins of an individual or populations of people. Now, moving on to targeted drug delivery, the idea here is that your nanobot, as shown here, again, nanoparticles and nanobots do not look like this. This is just an artist's rendition of what we describe to an artist as we talk about the idea of a particle circulating into the circulatory system and trying to find one trouble spot versus all this normal tissue that exists in the background. Ignore all this normal tissue. It's perfectly fine. Its structure is fine. Its function is fine. Its activity is fine. But you might have some type of abnormal spot that needs some attention. Protected drug delivery to target sites, using the nanoparticle and the nanobot to target one particular type over another, higher doses versus lower doses. Again, we're trying to have a concentrated dose specifically to this site here and not a site over here. Healthy tissue, healthy tissue remains unaffected. And again, the term of theragnostics, where not only do you want to have the identification of the trouble spot, but then you actually do something to the troubled tissue that you are trying to do something to at the same time. Here's an example for targeted drug delivery specifically with cancer. And it's these words over here on this side line up A, B, and C with the three different spots in the diagram, A, B, and C. So follow along there. The nanobot loaded with a chemotherapy lands on the blood vessel wall connected to the vasculature. Once latched on, the nanobot releases its drug through the blood vessel wall. The highly concentrated chemotherapy drug is then targeted directly to the cancer cell, which then subsequently dies. That's what we're looking for. In regenerative medicine, we're looking for intelligent biomaterials and nanomaterials that have an adjustable rate of biodegradation. This is really where the concept of timed release comes in. Can we produce a material that is stable in one particular situation, but then spontaneously dissolves or breaks open or cracks open like a cracked egg would crack open to release the yolk inside? Can we manage that and create that based off of experimental conditions of the targeted site? For instance, this particular area here where your nanobot landed in an area that had a lot of bacterial contamination, and then using the enzymes in the bacteria itself or the differential pH of the surrounding matrix cause the nanoparticle to dissolve its exterior coating and release the drug inside. Time programmable for tissue growth or for killing particular other types of contamination. Targeted cell implantation. And of course, biomimicking is very important in this particular type of research. So one thing that I really did not want to leave out of this particular talk is that ELSA compliance associated with developing novel and new generation of medicines, especially nanoparticles. Nanomedicine itself touches the familiar ethical, legal, and social aspects and implications associated with biomedical ethics, the gap between diagnostics and therapy, and the sensitivity of genetic information. But it also addresses some new ones. When do we call a person ill? So that's the main question here that we're talking about. Normally, you know, we really wait for a heightened concentration of a particular biomarker that tells us that the disease, the onset of disease, or the progression of disease. But yet you don't really call the person, quote, ill until a certain level of biomarker is detected in the fluid. What if we create nanomedicines that can detect lower concentrations of that particular biomarker? Then does our standard for diagnosing somebody as ill, is it changed? Do we become more sensitive? And how does that affect society in general? Do we all become a more ill population because we all have a basal expression of these biomarkers circulating inside of us? But when does it really become a person that is sick or ill or diseased versus one that's healthy? So we have some issues there to address. There's differences between medical treatment and medical enhancement, and that's a term, that a concept that is definitely used in a lot of other areas of medicine currently, but nanomedicines themselves and nanosupplements, and using nanoparticles in our food and our vitamins and taking them for supplemental growth factors or antimicrobial agents incorporated into other consumer products, we have to think about, is that something that's medical or is it something that's enhancement? Of course, obtaining public acceptance, because if a person thinks that a nanobot is really a robot in our circulatory system, people should be scared of, or not scared, but they should have reservations about something like that, versus the reality is these particles are spherical or rice-shaped or rod-shaped or tetrahedron-shaped particles that just happen to be on the same size scale as biomolecules. And then, of course, the last is the differences in the role of intellectual property between industries and between groups that are looking to collaborate with one another. There are regulatory challenges associated with this, and we don't have time to get into some of the regulatory challenges, but I encourage you to read up on the documents that are put out there by NIOSH, EPA, and the FDA. NIOSH for occupational guidance, EPA for environmental guidance, and FDA for food and drug guidance. So let's move on to a poll question at this point. What is the single most important aspect of nanomedicine? If you as a consumer were thinking about using nanomedicine for yourself, a parent, or a child, what are you looking for in the nanomedicine? Efficacy, A. Toxicity, B. Public acceptance, if you're thinking more on a regulatory or a population base, C. Cost, cost, the dollar sign, D. Or another type. Please enter your answer. That's a very interesting response, and I noticed that the general public acceptance is not really a priority for people who would be considering using an alternative medicine like nanomedicine to traditional medicine, so that's interesting. But also, the cost doesn't seem to be a deterrent, which is good too when it comes to thinking about the research and the idea that maybe people really would consider using, they're not really concerned about the increased cost, but they're looking for increased efficacy and decreased toxicity. Is now a good time to stop and have a discussion and maybe talk about this in a little bit more detail?
I think that's a good idea. We did have a couple of questions that came through, and again, I'd like to remind everyone to put a question in the chat box and send it to this room, and then we'll go ahead and address those now or at our last question break. But Dr. Sayes, here's a question from a little bit earlier from our participant, and he asked, the operation of nanoscale imaging systems is often handled by an operator who schedules imaging and viewing to prevent damage to probe tips, etc. Does this provide a bottleneck? Does it prevent students from directly using nanoscale instruments? And then to finish the question, our participant asks, do your students work directly with the instruments or go through an operator?
Those are very excellent questions. And I think we can think about these in a research training mode versus the actual application and using these in real live situations. Ideally, I would think that because nanotechnologists are really trying hard to not reinvent every single wheel that exists, we're trying to use the current technologies that already exist, like an NMR or CT scans or PET. We're trying to use those exact same instrumentation, but the contrast agents or the agents that are injected into the animal or human, that was what we're changing. And as we work toward finding the medicines that go into the circulatory system, we work hand in hand with the instrument companies that then increase their resolution to find smaller and smaller particles using their computerized tomography and other types of techniques. And I would envision that those would be two separate people. So it would potentially increase the cost of that particular application, because not only do you have the technician operating the instrument who's highly trained on the instrument, but then you also have another person administering the drug to the patient or to the animal itself. So I envision those as two separate tasks within the same test, although maybe in the future people could be cross-trained for both of them as we get a deeper understanding of the possible side effects associated with using nanomedicines in routine situations like that. When it comes to research, man, no way. The graduate students have access to everything. I want my graduate students, and I want any graduate student, to be exposed to not only the synthesis and characterization, but exposure to the animals to be able to look for the efficacy or the toxicity, and then take it all the way downfield to the instrument itself. A lot of universities these days are really focusing on translational research and researchers to go all the way from the very beginning, from bench all the way to bedside, to understand all parts of the life cycle that exist for using nanomaterials in research and for training. We are here at part two, which is a very short explanation and examples of a couple of commercialization case studies. So again, what we would like to ideally do is have another webinar that really goes into much more detail of the types of companies, either the startup companies or the spin-out companies, specifically the nanobio interface. Here are some examples of companies commercializing nanomaterials for biological and medical applications. And we'll go through a couple of these particular companies right here in this presentation. This chart has three different columns. The example name of the company shown here, the major area of activity and where their research and their R&D money is being invested, and then what technology are they really developing that is making its way into the consumer products and a consumer good for us to purchase. The first company here is Arginine, which works on membrane filtration. They develop nanoporous ceramic materials for endotoxin filtration and dental implants, and also for DNA protein separation. And we'll go through an example of their membrane filtration in just a second. Another company is Biofan Technologies, and they work in MRI. And so they're looking for exactly what I mentioned before, these nanomagnetic carbon composited materials to shield medical devices from RF fields. But they're also using these nano-sized particles as contrast agents in the circulatory system. This is not a misspelling of this company. I promise you, this is how they spell their company. It's a play off of capsules and then solution. So cap solution. Can we clear this? I just marked this up with a whole bunch of highlighting, and I don't like it. Is there a way to clear the highlighting off? Thank you. So that's not a misspelling of their company. If you do go and do some more further research on that particular company, notice the spelling. It's a little odd. They do pharmaceutical coatings to improve the solubility of drugs, and they use a lot of layer-by-layer polyethylene coatings, specifically focusing on the smallest of small nanoparticles, 8 nanometers, going up to about 50 nanometers. Evident Technologies, of course, that you might be familiar with them, but they are a very sophisticated company that really produces the best of the best quantum dots that we use in research or particular applications. With emissions, where a wide range of emissions, you can get them to tune their particles anywhere between 2,500 nanometers. And lastly, the larger company, Smith & Nephew, who works on coated bandages. They use the famous nanocrystalline colloidal silver, which is highly toxic to pathogens, but not really known to be very toxic or as toxic to mammalian cells. So let's start with the filter company here. Waterborne pathogenic microorganisms are a major source of disease worldwide. Pathogens and water system deficiencies that are identified in outbreaks may also be an important cause of endemic waterborne illnesses. So this company uses these particular, their copyrighted reserved filters, NanoCeram. They utilize a non-woven filter media containing a thermally bonded blend of microglass fibers and cellulose infused with nanoalumina fibers. And if you see an SEM, a scanning electron micrograph of their non-woven material, their filter, you see all these different types of materials, the glass and the cellulose and the alumina fibers all in the mesh. The method makes available greater than 42,000 square meters of nanofiber surface in just a very small area, just one per square meter. And again, what this does is the concept here, it filters out more bacteria than your and other pathogens compared to other types of filters that are on the market. Smith & Nephew, they have always made bandages, but they started adding silver-coated, highly-density polyethylene mesh on top of their normal rayon polyester bandage material. So by fusing the two together and actually sandwiching their normal rayon polyester bandage in between, sandwiching it between two silver-coated polyethylene meshes, they get this anti-coat product. And it's a family that offers a unique range of antimicrobial barrier dressings for use over partial or full thickness and over wounds. And so they have this patented silver technology. It's nanocrystalline. It offers antimicrobial protection, and they claim it's an effective barrier, and it kills not only more, but at a faster rate. Okay. So I think that's all we have for today, and I think we should open the floor to a discussion.
So the first thing I just wanted to remind everyone, our presenter today is Dr. Christy Sayes. She's the program manager of nanotoxicology and nanopharmacology at RTI International. Her email is there. If you have any specific questions, Dr. Sayes, is it okay that we offer this information to our participants to contact you?
Absolutely. Not only some technical questions, but also if there are students in the audience that need a bit of mentorship and how to navigate through the field of being the part of the next generation of nanotechnologists, I'm happy to mentor as well.
Perfect. Thank you very much for that. So Dr. Sayes, here's one from our audience. In your opinion, what are some of the intellectual property challenges for the public? Not for industry and not for researchers.
My first reaction to that is that I'm stumped. I really cannot speak to that. I know, of course, that there are intellectual property situations that we must be sensitive to when we're talking about industry-to-industry type of collaborations or university-to-industry type of collaborations. But intellectual property rights and privileges and whatnot for the general public, I just don't understand the question or know anything about that particular topic. I'm sorry.
Okay, that's fine. How about we turn to another question here from our audience? Are there any efforts in the regulatory community to look at the effects long term?
That's a very good question. One thing that we didn't bring up in this particular conversation, and we can save it for another time, is the role of the epidemiologist in the development of nanomedicines and the use of nanoparticles in consumer goods. Because right now, since nanotechnology is still a relatively young field, we as a population right now have not been exposed to a lot of engineered nanomaterials from our consumer goods. However, if we think about next generations, our children and our children's children, then those particular populations will probably be exposed to nanomaterials from birth all the way through their life. And so epidemiologists need to communicate, or actually I should turn that around, nanotechnologists need to communicate with epidemiologists sooner rather than later so that we can start some benchmark testing here in 2011. To get a basal expression of how people behave with particulate matter that is more incidental or naturally occurring versus the increase of engineered nanomaterials in our everyday life. So it's true that our bodies know how to deal with a lot of particulate matter, even nanoparticulate matter, but we're always going to be exposed to those things. We're always going to be exposed to pollution, to transcontinental sandstorms, to volcanic eruptions, to naturally occurring things, even particles coming from the combustion engine. The question is, on top of that, adding more engineered nanomaterials to our exposure situation above and beyond what we've been exposed to up until now, then how will populations deal with that? And that's the real struggle with the regulatory agencies, is to start thinking about things over 20-year spans. What are the unintended consequences and the unwarranted effects that would come out of using these novel particles and these wonderful particles that with the intention of it improving the human condition, but not thinking about or not knowing about unintended consequences?
Perfect. That's great information, Dr. Says. And finally, I'd like our participants to join me in giving a round of applause to our presenter, Dr. Christy Says. Thank you so much for presenting, and thank you to the audience for attending today's webinar, Tech Intersection, Understanding the Bio and Nano Link. Have a great day, everybody.